This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
What are the most memorable travel adventures? Those where we open our eyes and our minds to new experiences. It's all to see here in Azerbaijan. New flavors, a new appreciation of ancient history, of natural beauty and of rich contrasts. This is a world of culture, cuisine, wellness and adventure, all yours for the taking. Thought you knew Azerbaijan? Take another look. To plan your Azerbaijan adventure, visit azerbaijan.travel.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there, we really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. So there is a rise and a, well, let's look at the number of infections in a moment. Shall we start off with the mixed message that there is from health authorities north and south of the border over COVID? And then we'll try to get our heads around, for many of you who have been unwell, for many of you who are worried, what indeed is going on in Northern Ireland in terms of these respiratory infections. We think this is such an important story, we're putting it as the lead story on Nolan Show this morning. So here's what we know. A new variant is causing concern in the Republic. It's a variant of the JN1 strain, which is also present in Northern Ireland. The Department of Public Health in the Republic is encouraging people to be aware of the increase of COVID-19 infections in the community. And they're telling people, stay at home until 48 hours after your symptoms are mostly or fully gone. There is no such specific advice from the authorities in Northern Ireland. They're telling people avoid contact with other people, especially people at higher risk from COVID-19. We can't see that advice from the authorities here in Northern Ireland. They say avoid visiting those in healthcare settings such as hospitals and nursing homes if you're experiencing COVID-19 symptoms. We can't see that from the authorities here in Northern Ireland. The message in Northern Ireland is, if you have symptoms of a respiratory infection, we would advise you to avoid coming into unnecessary contact with other people. Well, what does that mean? Unnecessary contact. Does that mean stay at home, don't go to work, work from home? Does that mean, as strictly as the Republic are spelling it out, 48 hours after your symptoms have gone, that's when you stay at home too? Doesn't say that. Health journalist Paul Cullen is with us this morning. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we're hearing people anecdotally saying, look, you know, COVID's back. It's never gone away, of course, right?
Yeah, I was going to say that to you. That was going to be my first point. It's never gone away. We're in a situation where most countries in Europe are facing peaks in COVID every 3 or 5 months. It's going in waves. The experts are watching out for any tweak in the makeup of the virus that could turn it into something super dangerous again. But at the moment, they're satisfied that what's happening is part of the normal, or I say normal, but the trend over the last few years where there have peaks. And it's not seasonal. It is not a winter virus like the flu or RSV is. And so you're just as liable to experience it in the middle of the summer as in the winter.
So what do we do? What's the difference between here and the South? There's no difference in the infection. Is there a different policy?
No, absolutely not. The virus doesn't respect any borders, as we know. I mean, to be fair, in the Republic, the response has been low-key enough. New figures are out today, and they'll be watched with interest because there has been a 12-week, week-on-week increase in the figures here. Quite striking increase in the numbers. But as you mentioned, the advice here is to, even if you've got very mild symptoms, to isolate yourself for 48 hours, to opt out, to pull back from society. And to an extent, that works. I've been in hospitals recently over the last number of weeks, and I've seen a big increase in the amount of mask wearing by people visiting hospitals and in hospitals. And to the extent that the one I was with in on Monday had a kiosk at the entrance and was offering people masks who were going into the hospital, because there have been a large number of outbreaks in Irish hospitals. And as we know, that's where it spreads best, and that's where the most vulnerable people are.
Paul, thank you. Dr. Alan Stout, Chair of the Northern Ireland GP Committee. Good morning to you, Alan.
Good morning, Stephen.
So that's what they're looking at in the South. 48 hours after the symptoms have finished, stay at home until then. Why do you think we're not getting the same advice here?
Yeah, we kind of are getting the same advice here, if I'm being honest, because what the Republic are advising is just good respiratory hygiene. Good,
but you've
respiratory
told us there's
advice.
No. You've told us, Alan. You've told our team there is no official advice being given behind the scenes or guidance.
No, there's not. And there isn't specific COVID advice. There isn't specific advice on testing or on isolating. But there is, and if you go through the NI Direct website, it does refer to the good respiratory hygiene, which people became so familiar with through COVID. And that's important as well, because the context of this, and Paul mentioned it as well, is that we are seeing this increase. We're definitely seeing a new variant. It's come through the States. We know that it's here, but the good news is that it is behaving like we've expected it to behave. So it is less dangerous. It's probably more infectious, so it's probably spreading more and more. But we're absolutely, definitely not seeing these terrible kind of that cytokine response, the overload of people's lungs, the intensive care needs and everything else that we saw in that really early phase of COVID. So that is a positive, and so really through the authorities, they've got to have a very measured approach at this stage. And it's also worth putting in context that we are seeing a whole raft of other infectious diseases at the moment for various reasons.
But I want to get into that. So yeah, in terms of this whole raft, like some of it, like for example, I've been floored for 3 or 4 days. I've no idea what it is. I didn't get tested. I was told that the COVID test that I have in my house from back when COVID started, they're out of date. My mother became seriously, like she was very close to being hospitalized there over the last day or two. I had no idea what was going on. So what are these other respiratory diseases? What are they?
Yeah, well, there's quite a lot. I mean, you can get, so there is quite a lot of viral upper respiratory infections, which can then get complicated in some people. You can get secondary infections and bacterial chest infections. We've got a relatively low level of flu that's circulating at the moment, but there still is some circulating. We've got pertussis is actually something that is very high on our agenda at the moment. That is whooping cough, the 100-day cough. And some people are becoming quite unwell with that. And we have a particular concern with that, particularly around very young children and pregnant mothers as well, and the risks to young infants. But it is definitely affecting adults as well. And we've actually got very severe hay fever in some people at the moment. We've had high pollen counts, and that actually mimics a lot of the symptoms of the respiratory infection as well. So the combination of them all. But you're actually quite a good example, and as you describe it, so you've developed symptoms that have got a bit worse than you would have expected. And when you mention your mum, one of the absolute key things is if you then feel symptoms of infection, doesn't matter which one of those infections it is do everything you can to protect the people that are most vulnerable, and that is the elderly, and that is the immunocompromised, and the group that we're familiar with.
But that is why I want to talk through this with you today. And by the way, that 100-day cough, the amount of people talking to me about that, telling me they've had it, telling me that they've had something which has lasted with them for the first time in their lives, 10 weeks, 11 weeks. The prospect of that terrifies me.
Do you remember during COVID, we were focused on the R number, and we were very worried if the R number went above one, and certainly if it was getting to two or three, it was really concerning. The R number, whenever you get a pertussis outbreak, can be way over 10. It can be up to 15, 20. It is massively infective, so it just will spread right throughout a room. And so that is why you're seeing and hearing so many people with that.
Well, look, let's deal with that. Let's deal with that, then we'll come back to COVID. So this 100-day cough, is it what it says on the tin? Are you unwell for 10 weeks? And can you be seriously unwell for 10 weeks? Or what way does it play out?
Yeah, so very few people will be seriously unwell, particularly in the adult group. But the group that we're particularly concerned about are very young infants, where they don't. And that's where getting the vaccination in pregnancy is so important, because the mum will then confer the immunity to the newborn baby and protect the newborn baby. And that's where we've had the tragic stories UK-wide of the young babies dying with pertussis infection and the respiratory strain. So that's the real target with that. Pertussis itself has been a success
story. Is the whooping cough, is it?
That's whooping cough, exactly, yeah. And that's been a real success story, because we all but eradicated it, because it's vaccinated against, it's part of the childhood.
So how come it seems to be greater this year?
Yeah, because again, it comes back to vaccination, Stephen, because the UK Health Protection Agency is again stating that the vaccine numbers are dropping quite considerably. We used to be well over 95%. These are UK-wide figures. In under fives now, it's less than 85%. So you give a focus for the infection to take hold. It will take hold, and it will cause problems. And we keep coming back to this. We are so good at vaccinating. We're so good at protecting against what can be really severe illnesses. And we need to really refocus on that and make sure that we're getting the right people vaccinated at the right time.
In terms of the adult population, if they've been vaccinated as a child, does that protection continue throughout life for this?
It should do. It will wane with time, but there's no actual booster that is given, because again the risk of infection starts to diminish quite considerably, but they will retain a degree of protection. But again, we will see people now who are a long time from vaccination with the waning effect, and they will actually get infection at this point, particularly because it's so infectious and because it's so prevalent.
And how bad are the symptoms? Is it what it says in the tin? You're constantly coughing day after day.
Yeah, so like every infection, you'll have
that must be exhausting.
Spectrum. Yeah, it is, and particularly at night, people particularly notice it. But any infection has a whole spectrum of effect on people. So some people will just brush it off, and it won't really be a problem. It'll be a bit of an ardent cough, but some people get really affected by it. And like so many infections, the worst affected tend to be the people that are most vulnerable to it as well.
So if you get it, what does the doctor give you to get through it?
Yeah, so, I mean, certainly with whooping cough, we would give antibiotics in that sense. But for a lot of the other infections, and this is where it becomes very difficult to differentiate, and why we also have a concern about increasing use of antibiotics, because without actually testing and knowing, all of these different infections kind of mimic each other. You know, so it can be difficult to differentiate which one it is. And there always is a fear and a reluctance to overuse antibiotics, and because then we'll create yet another problem, which is antibiotic resistance, which has been something that we've been concerned about for quite some time.
You've talked about, before we leave the whooping cough, you've talked about it is very highly infectious. So does that mean, Alan, it is irresponsible of someone who is portraying the symptoms of whooping cough to come into work, for example? They might be tempted to soldier on. This is a highly infectious, this is highly infectious. So what do? Do they stay at home? And how long do you stay at home from when symptoms start?
Yeah, so again, there is no firm and fast advice on that. If you're displaying...
Well, come on, there needs to be, doesn't there? We don't know what to do as ordinary citizens. Yeah. We need advice from you guys, the doctors.
Yeah. No, well, that's exactly what I was about to lead to. So I think if you're experiencing symptoms of infection, so you know that you are infected, it is good, straightforward respiratory advice, which was there during COVID, is there now, and will remain the advice for quite some time to come, is to reduce, a wee bit like the Republic have said, is to reduce your contact. So that would be, if you can work from home, and avoid public transport, avoid crowded spaces, avoid healthcare environments as well. And absolutely avoid vulnerable people, and particularly the elderly, who are going to be more vulnerable to severe infection.
Well, the difference is they've said it in the South specifically. They've spelt it out in clear messaging. Is that what we need here from the authorities?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what the Republic have done is they have reminded people of the advice that is there. So they've really just re-stimulated the advice that is there that a lot of people know. And again, don't forget, and I'm never afraid to say this, I mean, I am massively impressed in my own surgery, and we see the whole cross-section of the community, 99% of people are really, really sensible. I'm amazed how many people actually contact us and tell us they have tested, because there is no firm advice to test, but they will test themselves anyway, and they'll phone us and tell us they've had a positive COVID test, or that their respiratory symptoms and their COVID test is negative. You know, and so the vast majority of people do the sensible things. But I think you're right. I mean, and even you talking about it today is kind of reinforcing that message and saying, you know, we just need to be careful. We need to be sensible.
But there needs to be specific advice. For example, it is slightly easier for people in the public sector whose wages will not be affected if they're staying at home, compared to the self-employed, compared to those bricklayers, those taxi drivers, those people who, if they don't go to work, the salary doesn't come in. Let's take, for example, the taxi driver community. If they're sitting in a cab, they've got the whooping cough. Are they likely to infect passengers getting in and out of that closed space of a car?
Oh, yeah, they would do. Yeah, if they're coughing and they're spreading it, they would do. But again, you know, that's a group of people who tend to be very, very sensible, very, very aware as well. Actually, I mean, I think the bigger issue for them is taking a lot of passengers and the risk they will get lots and lots of exposure through the day. And so they, just by a group, are going to be
they're
more exposed
at risk
as well.
The passengers.
Yeah. And I think, I think it is, protecting anybody in that sort of environment is why the advice is important as well. So, I mean, I think you're entirely right. I don't think we can't go back to anything like a furlough scheme or anything like that. You know, that's just not practicable. But it's just about, if as many people as possible are doing the right thing, then we'll protect each other.
We've talked a lot about the whooping cough. Let's move back to COVID now. This new variant, JN1, circulating in Ireland, we know that it's here in Northern Ireland as well. I just want you to help me understand the language within this statement for me from the Department of Health, because or the Public Health Agency, is it? Health and Social Care in Northern Ireland is where we got it from. So what it says is, it is important to be aware of the symptoms that could be caused by COVID-19 infection so that you can exercise caution and take action to reduce the risk of spreading it to other people, some of whom might be particularly vulnerable. The current COVID-19 spring booster campaign, which offers vaccination to individuals aged 6 months and over who are immunosuppressed, is coming to a close this week. But there are still a few days left for eligible people to take up the offer to help protect themselves over the summer period. So that says people who are immunosuppressed. What about those people who are caring for an elderly person, who are caring for someone who are immunosuppressed? Should they have got this booster? And if they haven't, should they get it now?
Yeah, so the booster campaign, actually, they left a bit out of that, because the booster campaign, the most recent one, covered over 75s as well. And that was important. Again, that was protecting the most vulnerable. Now, you've got me on the hop here. I can't actually remember whether it covered carers as well, but there was always a bit of discretion within that with a large amount done through GP surgeries, that if you were that regular contact, that regular care for a vulnerable person, that you would have got that as well.
You see, of course I'm talking here with myself in mind, right? But I'm talking about what many people do. 30, 40, 50-year-old adults listening to this program now, they visit their parents. So yeah, there will be a lot of people, and they visit their grandmothers, and so it goes on. So if, for example, you take a lot of the population who will be listening to this program this morning, and every weekend the kids go and they visit granny or granddad.
Yeah.
Or as a son or a daughter, you go 3 or 4 times a week up to make sure your mum or dad is okay. And they're over 75.
Yeah.
Should you have got this booster?
No. No. And again, it comes back to the purpose of vaccinating. So there's three key purposes of vaccination. One, and absolutely top of the list by a distance, is to protect you from getting serious illness. So you could still get infection, but the vaccine will protect you from becoming seriously ill. If it does that, that's a successful vaccine, and it does that. The second is to prevent the spread of infection. That is an add-on. The COVID vaccine hasn't really done that. That is if you start to control the infection spread within a population. And the third, which is very rare to happen, but does on occasions, is the eradication of illness altogether. And actually, measles used to be an example of that, where WHO designated the UK as a whole as measles free, meaning we didn't originate any cases of measles within the UK. So we largely eradicated measles, but because vaccination rates have dropped, it's now come back, and we no longer have that status. But the absolute first and foremost is that vulnerable person, so your mum or any elderly relative, if they're vaccinated, they will be getting the protection. That's the fundamental intention and aim with the vaccination program at this stage.
I want to labour the point one more time, Alan. I don't think this is the most exciting radio, but I think it's really important. So those practical everyday decisions, if it's important that your mother, father or granny or granddad is visited, but if you're displaying the symptoms of, for example, whooping cough or COVID, do you stay away with all the down? What is the benefit cost analysis in this? If there is a detriment to that person not visiting them, is there a greater risk from the infection? Do you stay away?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is just sensible advice. If you are infection, if you're displaying those symptoms of infection, and actually regardless of what the infection is, it is just good, simple health advice to stay away. Now, I agree with what you're intimating with within the question. I think circumstances will affect that. So if you're thinking of a palliative patient and maybe end of life and so on and such like, I think it's entirely appropriate that people would make sensible decisions and nuanced decisions.
That's not what I was talking about. I was talking about the more everyday. Well, look, let's talk about my situation. So it's very important. My mum comes down to my house on a Tuesday and a Saturday, and we spend time together. I started feeling I had a slight temperature on Friday, and then it got dramatically worse while I was working from home on Friday night into Five Life. The next day, my mother was in my house. Yeah. And it's really important to her that she's around me. Then I started to get worse and worse. Mum was around me. By Monday morning, I'm feeling incredibly guilty. Mum's flattened. Yeah. And I don't know what the right decision was, even right now. Should I have sent her home on her own? This is too dangerous if you're over 70.
Yeah, so, okay. So my intention is not to make you feel guilty in any way, shape or form. My advice at that point would have been you're better to kind of pass, let that weekend pass and maybe not see her, because the implications of spreading the infection to an older and more vulnerable person are quite significant. And she will, if you feel it at 50%, she'll feel it at 90%. You know, it is a much bigger impact of infection. So if you don't have to see them and you are definitely displaying those signs of infection, and again, within that context of you're not entirely sure what your infection is, because it could be COVID, it could be another viral infection, it could be pertussis, you know, so it is about just minimizing that risk.
What's more dangerous to an elderly person, whooping cough, which we've talked about, or COVID?
Most likely COVID, and again, we would see that pattern year after year. We've seen that for many years with flu, where we've always had deaths from flu every year. Vaccination against flu protects against the vast majority of those, but we've always seen deaths, and so, you know, that is well established that those infections will target the elderly and most vulnerable the hardest.
I have three more brief questions. I know you're a busy man. I want to pause for one sec, get the news, ask those questions, let you escape me. All right? Let's take the news at 9:31. Dr. Alan Stout is with us this morning. We appreciate his expertise. What we're trying to do today is just get you as much information as possible, as so many of us. Like, I very much doubt there's any of your social groups where at least one of you haven't got one of these respiratory infections. Certainly everybody I know knows of someone that has. Alan, help me understand part of this statement from the Department of Health, and it just might be me not being able to get my head around it, right? They say there is no evidence at present of any recent changes having resulted in greater transmissibility or more serious infection. So no greater transmissibility. And then they say, while there has been an increase in community cases and hospital admissions. So how is there no greater transmissibility and there's an increase in transmission? There's an increase in cases.
Yeah, I think what they're probably referring to in that is that they're stating that we're not seeing the severity of illness. So we're seeing, I mean, the variant that's circulating at the moment is another variant of the Omicron variant, which is actually very transmissible. And again, back to what I said earlier, you know, this is just the nature, this is the evolution of the virus, which is what we expected, is that it becomes more transmissible, but less dangerous. And that is just the nature of viruses. They evolve, they change, and what they do is they escape the host's protection so that they survive themselves. But by doing that, they actually reduce the severity of the illness that they cause as well. And I suspect that's exactly what the department statement is referring to.
Here we are, heading into July. There may be extreme heat. There often is. What do we do when we have infection? We sweat. We burn up, we sweat, and then that's in hot weather. And then if you take some of our most vulnerable community, the elderly, many of them like the heat turned up in their homes. Many of us experience getting into our mums and dads or grannies and granddads and the heat's pumped up.
Yeah.
How important is it in that context for us all, but particularly elderly people, to drink water? And how easy is it to become dehydrated? And how dangerous is it?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, infection will make you more dehydrated. And actually, we see that in the elderly population quite a lot, is that they can become dehydrated. And then that causes other effects. And one of the predominant symptoms and signs that we see quite often is confusion, which is coupled both with infection and also with dehydration. So you're absolutely right. It is important to keep well hydrated. And particularly as
like, how many glasses of water should someone be drinking a day?
Yeah, so again, it's hard. There's no hard and fast rule with that. What I would always suggest is, if you're drinking enough that you're needing to go to the loo roughly every hour, you're going to be well hydrated. If you're not needing to go to the loo for 3, 4, 5 hours, you're likely to be dehydrated. And again, people come to us a lot, and they're very lethargic, and they're maybe getting headaches and so on as well. And a lot of that can be attributable, these kind of lower level sort of symptoms are attributable to dehydration as well. I remember one expert telling me at one point, I think the figure that he used was about 70% of the population is actually dehydrated at any one point in time. So most people don't actually drink enough water.
Here's Marty on the line. Morning, Marty.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead. Thanks for calling, sir.
I was at a wedding in County Monaghan on Saturday and came home Sunday, grand, and then went out for a walk, and I was walking up the hill and I was badly out of breath, which was unlikely. I remember the first time I had COVID, it was the kind of same symptoms that hit me. So I came home and dug out a ground-out test that I had. Took the test, positive. Like, all right. Right, so rang my mum and the elderly. I said, listen, stay away from me. I'm positive of COVID. They're in their 80s, so they are. So then Sunday night went to bed, and then Monday, absolutely busted. Absolutely just... Like the first time I had COVID again, couldn't get out of bed, sweat beating off me. So I just lay there, rang the boss, said, listen, I'll not be in today as we have tested positive for COVID. And I work in an open plan office. And he was like, listen, don't be coming in. Don't be coming in until you're clear. He says, because I don't want a whole pile of people off work at the same time. I was like, yeah, no problem. So I took my own decision to self-isolate.
Yeah,
because I have good friends of mine, and their parents are, some of them are in nursing homes, and some of them are elderly, and I'd hate to pass it on to them, and for them to be end up poorly or something even
well,
more.
Whatever it is, I had, and I don't know if it was COVID. I don't know what it is I had, right? But when I saw the look, when I saw my mother over the last couple of days, like, I felt profoundly guilty. She was flattened. Absolutely flattened by something that I had given her. And here I am now. Like, this is the first day. Like, I'm starting to sound a wee bit better. I've still a bit of a temperature. But I'm doing the program from home this morning because I don't want to pass it around the rest of the team.
I'm working from home because we basically you don't want to pass it on. And we all remember 4 or 5 years ago, whenever we were, you know, people were dropping down, dying in nursing homes, and having that on your conscience, you would be absolutely atrocious.
Marty, thank you. Morning to you. 030 30 80 55 55. I hope you all feel this is beneficial this morning. David on the line. Morning, David. Sorry, David's dropped off. Okay. Well, look, Alan, I think that's been really valuable today. It is that weighing up, isn't it, that we all do in life of, you know,
absolutely,
what's best and what's not. But
Marty, sorry, I was just going to say, Marty, there is your last caller, is a perfect example of what I was referring to and what we hear in surgery over and over again. You know, there is a sensible person. He's identified early and he's done very, very sensible measures, all off his own bat. And thankfully and fortunately for us all, that's exactly what the vast majority of people do. And I think it is beneficial that you're reinforcing that message today as well.
I hesitate to say this because the flack will come in, but it's the right question, so I'm asking it. Should we be considering, for those of us that have symptoms or given the infection rates that there are, should some of us be considering wearing a mask if we are around vulnerable people?
Yeah, so some people will. And again, if we've got to go back to the purpose of the masks, which was for the asymptomatic transmission, particularly during COVID. So I think if you're symptomatic and if you have to go into an enclosed space for some reason, I think, you know, you're going to be doing a big, big favour to all those other people if you're wearing a mask and reducing your shedding of the virus. I don't think we're at the point at the moment that we need the wide use of masks or anything like that. And again, you'd base that very much on the severity and the impact of the infection itself.
I'm just mindful, finally, of all of those carers that we've got, all of those domiciliary care workers we've got, all of those taxi drivers, all of those people who interact with hundreds of people every single day. And are they vulnerable to this?
Yeah, absolutely. And our healthcare workers as well. I mean, our healthcare workers are going in and treating the most severe of the cases every single day as well. And again, that was what came out loud and clear in COVID, is they have no hesitation in putting themselves in the front line and making sure that people remain well.
And if we have either of these two infections, in the vast, vast majority of cases, you know, you'll recover in a few days. At what stage do you need an antibiotic? At what stage do you or do you not phone the doctor?
Yeah, I think that'll vary. But if your symptoms are persisting, particularly if they're starting to get worse, so I think you and Marty both were describing where you had a bad couple of days and you're starting to get better. But if you've had a bad couple of days and you start to get worse, and if you've got persisting high temperatures, or if you start to develop any other quite specific symptom, then that would be very much when you'd contact your doctor, and an antibiotic might be an option at that stage.
Dr. Alan Stout, thank you very much. Thank you, Alan. As always, thank you, sir. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. Now, next, Liverpool City Council has put plans in place to make the city smoke-free by 2030. They say they want to denormalise smoking by banning it from more public places and using existing laws to step up controls on the supply of tobacco. I've been speaking to commentators Emma Wolfe, Lembit Opik. Began by asking Lembit if this is realistic.
It's not realistic, but more than that, even if it was, it is the greatest intrusion on adult decision-making that we've had in decades, because it's telling us that the public are too stupid to decide what things they can do which are good for them, what things they can do that are bad for them. The precedent might as well go all the way. Why don't we just ban alcohol, which generally isn't very good for you? What about fatty foods? What about fast food? The point here is it's virtue signaling nonsense, which infantilizes our society by saying that the state knows better than you do and uses banning things as a way to try to protect us from ourselves. And it's a very dangerous authoritarian route, and I'm completely against it. And I think the public would simply ignore it. It wouldn't be enforceable.
Emma?
Well, the difference, obviously, Lembit, is that smoking affects people around you. So passive smoking affects people in an area, whereas, you know, drinking alcohol or being obese, eating fatty foods, any of those things don't actually affect people in the vicinity. Of course, they're extremely dangerous as well. But we know that smoking is one of the most obvious and clearest killers of our, you know, modern day. 17% of Liverpudlians are still smoking, which is hence their plan to try to make more public places smoke-free. And it disproportionately affects, you know, poorer, more disadvantaged families and communities. So I think that what they're trying to do is to denormalize smoking in public places. I think it's a really good idea. I was a smoker. I know it's a very, very difficult addiction to kick. And I know that when you can't smoke in certain places, it does prevent you from smoking. My worry, Stephen, my worry is that it will drive it basically indoors so that, you know, then children and babies suffer when you have people basically staying at home, windows closed, smoking away in cars, smoking away in private homes, in private property, i.e. cars, wherever. That is a concern.
There's a couple of things.
According to the council, Lambert, it's the biggest preventable killer. And the report to the council's cabinet, this is Liverpool Council's cabinet, said that the aim is to help Liverpudlians live longer, healthier and wealthier lives in a city.
Great. Well, OK, then why don't we simply can get everybody to give all their money to the council and the council can decide what's good for us. The fact that less wealthy people tend to smoke more is a clue that it's a displacement behaviour. We know this because those people, they don't go to Costa Rica for their holidays because they can't afford it. Now we're taking this fairly simple, albeit health-damaging, pleasure away. And to say that smoking, does passive smoking in a public place does more damage than alcohol, go to any A&E on a Friday or Saturday night, as I have done, and you can see the third-party damage alcohol does. Frankly, if you banned alcohol, that would do an awful lot better for the health service in the short term than banning smoking. But that's not my fundamental point here. Where do we draw the line about personal volition, personal freedom, and the state's right to stop us? Because literally, if you do this, you might as well go down the whole hog. Let's reduce speed limits to 5 miles an hour. Then very few people would be killed on our roads. Let's certainly ban cycling, because cycling has a pretty bad record of injury and death. But you see, it's all selective. It's all woke.
Nonsense about cycling. That's absolute nonsense. I don't even know where you've come up with that from.
Well, I'll tell you where I come up with it, because I looked at this professionally. During the COVID lockdowns, traffic went down by about a fifth. Cycling went up by about 40%. Cycling deaths went up by 40%. There's an absolutely clear correlation between the amount of cycling and the amount of death. The point I'm making, I'm not really recommending we do that. The point I'm making is the crazy logic of beginning to tell us what we should do for our own good would ban cycling. And incidentally, there's also a causal link between intense cycling and prostate cancer. So if we just pick and choose the things that we think are bad for us, then we're ignoring all of that. That's why, as a libertarian, I'm totally against this. I'm not a smoker. I'm totally against it. And show me the evidence. Show me the evidence where passive smoking in public places is shown to cause health damage. There isn't any.
No one disputes that smoking is one of the biggest preventable causes of disease and death. And the NHS is under huge pressure at the moment. I think this is a first step, but I do worry that it'll be driven into people's homes instead. And people just simply, I mean, I know someone who says, well, I don't go to the pub because I can't smoke there anymore, which is, you know, not ideal, because instead he stays at home and smokes. But what I would like is to see Liverpool also putting money into education, stopping young people from starting in the beginning. And we know that, you know, there are a lot fewer young people who now smoke than there were 50 years ago. But we have to admit it is still a sort of habit or a disease of poorer and less advantaged families and communities. And that is why we really, really need to focus on this as support for people, helping people to give up, especially for things like young mothers who are pregnant. That's often an area where people just simply don't stay because of the shame, in maternity care. To really prevent people and help them give up, don't just ban them.
I was surprised by the statistic. Liverpool City Council said about 17% of the city's residents were smokers, and they spent up to £2,500 annually on it. 17%?
Lower than it used to be, Stephen. That's a lot lower. I mean, you know, in decades past, you'd have 40, 50% of the population smoking. 17%.
Yeah, but in 2024, 1 in 5 residents are smokers?
Now, the fact is, that tells you something about the state of mind and the historically as well. It tells us something about the city, but the state of mind of people. I'm not a smoker, but I absolutely oppose the idea of mandation, of bans. Sure, I agree with everything you're suggesting in terms of encouraging people not to smoke. But if someone says to me, "I'm a smoker," well, you're banned.
Limit your ban from not driving down the road without a seatbelt. Are you saying that's crazy? You're banned from, you know, not having baldy tires on a car. You're banned from lots of things. It's called protecting wider society, is it not?
But there's a crucial point. Well, I was actually against the ban. Sorry, against the mandatory use of helmets on motorbikes, exactly for the same reason. I am consistent on this. I do have issues about the seatbelt question as well, mandation, because I've got a principle here. And the principle is quite simple. My concern is that when you start stopping people doing things that don't harm third parties, or you force them to do something which is in their best interest, you become an authoritarian state. I agree with the idea
smoking
of making people be responsible,
party, obviously,
but not forcing them.
Passive smoking harms third parties.
But can I give you the perspective of a former smoker?
Hang on. There's no evidence, whatever, that passive smoking in a public place causes third-party harm. There is plenty of evidence.
I mean, if people are inhaling smoke, we know that's damaging. But can I give you the perspective of a former smoker, Stephen? In 2007, they brought in a ban on smoking indoors. I gave up smoking. I thought then that actually impelled me, and I was hooked, and I'd smoked since my teens, and I thought, do you know what? I'm going to do this just before the ban comes in. I don't want them telling me what to. It actually, well, it doesn't matter what the impetus was, the motivation. I gave up smoking, and I have never smoked since. And so it does have an effect. It does help people. Whether or not that's right or wrong, it gave me the spur. It gave me this, you know, the kick up the backside that I needed. I gave up smoking. That's just one example. And I was a smoker. And I know, neither of you have smoked. I know how addictive it is.
I admire that you have the self-discipline. I'm not against what you would like to achieve. I'm against the method. And here's why. Because you haven't really answered this. First of all, there is no evidence to show that smoking in a park, for example, has ever harmed a third party. There's no evidence. It's not true. But there is plenty of evidence that on a Saturday night, a lot of third parties get harmed because so many people are drunk in our streets. We should, if you really want to go down this path, start with drinking. I've gone out in Liverpool. I've seen what it's like in Liverpool. Why don't you start with that and see how far you get with that policy? Why is it okay to get hammered and pick a fight with somebody you don't know, but it's not okay to smoke passively in a public place
But with respect, I'm not interested in the kind of whataboutery of alcohol. That's harmful too. I'm just simply talking about the every person we can help and support and encourage and even bully into giving up smoking, that is potentially a life saved.
Yeah, I agree with
it's
that.
It's a horrible, horrible habit. One's quality of life as a smoker is horrible. You can't breathe, you wake up, and I'm fit and young, you know, that waking up every morning, coughing, you're not fit, you stink, it's horrible, it's expensive, massive toll on the NHS. I think it's such an awful habit, and I say that with sympathy and with empathy, that I think any person we can help and support by whatever means to give up is a good thing.
Okay,
How difficult was it to give them up?
There's one difference between you and me. I agree with what your aim is. I would like there not to be alcoholism in this country. I'd like there to not be heroin addiction. But I'm not believing that prohibition works. Heroin is illegal. The most successful time in this country in dealing with heroin addiction was up till 1973, when you could essentially get it prescribed. A very small number of heroin addicts. Then it was made illegal, and now we've got a record number of people with heroin problems in this country. Now, with cigarettes, you and I both agree, it will be driven indoors. It'll be driven to places where you can't see it. Much better to have the education process you've described. I agree with that. But when you start telling the public that they're too stupid to make these decisions for themselves, I draw the line at that. You've got lots of self-discipline. Others haven't. You just drive it underground.
How difficult, Emma, was it to give them up?
Oh, my God. Stephen, I've achieved a few things in my life. I overcame anorexia, a potentially fatal eating disorder, all of that stuff. Nothing comes close. It was so hard to give up, and that is why I will never, and I'm full of empathy for smokers. I never blame them. It's really hard. I will never touch a cigarette again. Do you know why? Because I don't think I could give up again. I know if I go if I had one cigarette, I'd be a smoker again. Nicotine is stronger. It's a more powerful addiction than heroin, alcohol, anything. How did I do it? I knew this ban was coming in 2007, and I thought every single day, just get through each day, get through each hour. So don't wake up and have a cigarette. Don't have a cigarette with your coffee. Every single hour, that first day that I didn't have a cigarette was a win. Then I was on to day two. Then I was on to day three. And I also did that weird, do you remember Alan Carr? Stop smoking, whatever. He had that method. I read that book. He explained that it's not a need, it's a lack. So every time you have a cigarette, you're creating that craving again. And somehow I told myself, no, every time you have a cigarette, you're recreating that craving. So the longer you can go, just keep going.
Did you do it because you're a mum?
No, I wasn't. This is, 2007? This is 17 years ago.
All right, okay. Okay. Wow, that's a long time ago. And you haven't had one since? 17
years? Never had a cigarette since. Wow. And I still, once in a while, I don't think about it day to day, but once in a while I still miss it. And I still think, oh, it'd be so nice. Like when you're having a coffee or a glass of wine, I think, it'd be so nice to have a cigarette with that.
And Lembit, finally, Lembit, from you, are you missing politics now we're heading towards the election?
Actually, there's a certain similarity between smoking and politics. You think it's out of your system, but then you have a relapse. And every time there's a general election, I just can't help watching the telly. I miss it. The first time since I left Parliament, I wanted to be a candidate. Maybe watch this space. I might be back.
I bet you're not missing the rainy campaigning and battering on people's doors, though.
The thing is, you forget the bad parts, and then you think, oh, I could do that. Gives a job, to quote Yossa Hughes from Liverpool.
Well, let me pick up on that. So what are you contemplating? What's in your head?
I'm tremendously disappointed by what's getting to be called the Uni Party, Labour and Conservative. Starmer could run Tories and Sunak could run the Labour Party. We need a change. I got involved in politics at the beginning. It's actually because of all this libertarian stuff we've been talking about. I don't see anyone at the moment heading towards Downing Street who represents me. So what would I do? Well, maybe if the new parties bury the old parties, Workers' Party on the left, Reform Party on the right, politics might get interesting again. And that's what might bring me back
in. So why aren't you standing then?
Pardon? Because I was very put off by the direction politics was going. There didn't seem to be a way out from what I think has been a catastrophic mismanagement by successive governments in the last 20 years or so. But now I can see a potential shift. Maybe the public saying, we've actually had enough of the old lot. That's exciting. I suppose in a way I'm a political maverick.
So what's your time scale?
Well, I've missed this election, so possibly the next one. But it's only if there's a credible chance to make a difference. The conversation we've just had about smoking, I would love to have that quality of debate in the Commons. You just don't get it. It's been reduced to party nonsense. At least whoever's right or wrong here is less important. We've had a proper debate. If that's what's on offer in the Commons, then I'm in.
Lembit and Emma, thank you very much indeed. Thanks for talking to us.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Right, we have a couple of minutes before the news. Let's head back to our top story. You're calling us about COVID and these respiratory infections. Martin, hello, Martin.
Hello, Stephen.
Go ahead, sir.
I got COVID at the start, and it was bad to the stage it laid me up, and I had to be hospitalised.
Oh, dear.
I've got chronic asthma, and they've said I've got long COVID. I've had it now 4 times. Since, and unfortunately, I have them now coming in that they are sanitizing the place. They're washing the desks down with sanitizer, and they're cleaning everywhere, the phones, the computers, the door handles, the stair rails. I have them doing everywhere, and they're doing it naturally. I do think we need to go back to wearing masks.
Do you?
Yeah, I really do. I have a mask in my car.
Dr. Stout said he doesn't think we're at that stage.
Yeah. My wife works in a nursery, and the amount of kids that are still getting COVID, and the mothers are sending them in the nursery, and they're having
and
to
your
be
long COVID.
Can you come and get them?
Your long COVID has clearly affected you long term, by the very nature of the title of it.
Yep, it has. They give me class. They've tried. The NHS gave me classes to go to speech therapy to teach me to talk again. And then I had to learn to breathe again, which sounds silly, but I had to learn how to talk again and to get myself back on the road.
I had to learn how to talk again. Tell you what, stay there. I'm interested in this. Stay there. We'll talk to you more after the 10 o'clock news. We're talking about COVID and these respiratory infections which are doing the rounds throughout Northern Ireland, and what we should and shouldn't be doing, and just those everyday dilemmas. When you're not feeling well, do you still visit mum and dad? Do you still visit granny and granddad? What if they get it? At what point do you phone the doctor? And the importance of drinking water in this hot weather. And then if you have the infection and your body's sweating and you're losing water, the importance of drinking glasses of water. Dr. Stout telling us this morning that you should be drinking water every hour. And if you're not needing, therefore, to pee every hour, you should be starting to think if you're drinking enough. I never knew that. Back to Martin. Morning, Martin.
Morning, Stephen.
This has all prompted you to call us. You were telling us just before we went to the news that the long COVID that you developed meant that you had to learn to talk again. Now, I just don't understand that. So help me understand what happened to you.
When I talk, I have to take breaths in between talking because my words wouldn't come out. They became muddled. And if I was saying something, I would get it back to front. And words just were all muddled in my head. They're in my head the right way round. But they came out of my mouth the wrong way round. And
how? Because COVID surely affected your breathing, not your brain.
Fascinating. You get brain fog. It's called brain fog. And they organised for me to speak to a speech therapist to teach me how to breathe so that I could talk properly. And if I get stressed or anxiety builds up, you end up doing it what I'm doing at the moment because I know I'm on air and it makes you... You're conscious and you learn to breathe. It's like Gareth Gates, whenever he has a stammer, you have to learn to breathe. But because there's so many people wanting the treatment, I was entitled to 12 weeks of therapy. It could cut short after 5 because they run out of money.
Whoa.
The attitude
was... Where does that leave you?
Well, I had to do it myself. And there was a WhatsApp group started for people with long COVID. And we worked with one another to build it up to get it to where we are. And if I'm not...
You're saying to me... And look, there's some COVID deniers, for goodness sake.
Thinks it's a conspiracy.
Well, does he still think that, looking at you?
Well, I'm back to work and I get tired. I can fall asleep very easy. I could be sitting on the chair and the next thing I'm like cold. Now, my work are very good. They understand it and they've accepted it and said if you feel it coming on, go and take a break away and sit down and rest for the 10 minutes or 15 minutes to get recharge your batteries. So I have to give my work their dues. They've been very good about it.
So you went from a relatively healthy man, is this right?
Yeah.
You were relatively healthy.
I was 50, whenever it came out, I was 54 when COVID hit and I was fine. I had asthma. But it made everything worse to the stage that breathing was atrocious. Couldn't go out, couldn't walk the length of myself, and just everywhere you want to go, you were having to drive. But I couldn't drive because I knew I could fall asleep, so I couldn't drive. And you just have to change your lifestyle. And you learn to do it.
So you're having to think about breathing while talking.
Yeah. But whoa. You go into a stressful situation that's not natural, normal. This is the way I am now is because I'm having to think, and it brings on anxiety and stress that you have to think about what you're saying. And for Dr. Stout to say, oh, we don't need to go down the marks, I don't know what world he's living in. I really don't, because the amount of people with COVID still and getting it is unreal. My work said treat it as a cold. You go off for 3 days and stay off for 3 days until you recover. I'm right, you know, I'm long COVID registered, and they just went, yeah, but don't worry about that. But then, on the other hand, if I'm tired, they know I have to go and take a break. It just amazes me that I don't think some of the doctors are in the real world. I think Robin Swan was brilliant at his job. He'd done the best that he could with what he had, but we're still having problems.
Listen, thank you so much for sharing your story with me. I hope you're okay.
Oh, going into the future. I am. Thank you. I'm really good at the moment. Really, good. Really, really good at the moment.
That's good. Listen, thank you so much.
Thank you for letting me share the people. Long no COVID problem. Is out there, and COVID is still out there.
Not a problem, sir. Thank you. My goodness. This thing that we're just all talking about with each other in our separate friendship groups, such and such is off work. They've got COVID again. Such and such is off work. They've got the whooping cough, all of this. I think what we're showing today on this program is just the collective discussion that's going around Northern Ireland about what's going on, what are the implications of it, and reminding ourselves of how people are affected by it. And look, if you need, you know, maybe your granny, your granddad, your mum or dad, whoever it is, my goodness, your son or your daughter going to school to understand all the implications of this and infection control and how important it is, maybe you could get today's programme on BBC Sounds. If you download the app, it's there. It's Dr. Alan Stout talking you through all the details around it. Just search for The Nolan Show on BBC Sounds. We're talking about smoking, smoke-free cities also this morning. Philip, morning, Philip.
Morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Go ahead, yeah, sir.
Okay. Stephen, my mum, she worked for Gallagher. She, you know, back then, I think it was about the 50s. She went straight from school into the factory, free cigarettes, Gallagher's, like. And she contracted, like, I don't know if there's a link. I'm sure there is between smoking and COPD, but that condition really took its toll on her, you know. And whenever I smoked for 2 years, but she says, my mum said at the time, if I stopped smoking, she would stop, but she'd already been smoking 40, 50 years, and I stopped, so I did, you know.
So you stopped?
Ah, yeah, that was about 10, 15 years ago. I was working at the time, like, it was just chain smoking.
Difficult to stop, mate, right?
Very much so. And then I tried the patches, Stephen, and I got dizzy. I was probably smoking at the same time, which isn't recommended, like, or I might not have been. I'm not 100% sure, but either way, like, I was getting these dizzy spells with the patches, and maybe I was taking me away from the nicotine. I don't know how it works, Stephen, but you should, people out there should never give up and giving up on them. Cause even when I pass people, I would say you should give up, not, you know what I mean, but sometimes you get things said, but then you have to prepare for that, you know what I mean? You don't really, sometimes it's good coming from a stranger, you know, saying, you know, you should give up on them.
It's the saddest thing out. I still see it sometimes. I'm driving into work and I see someone in a school uniform smoking. And I just think to myself, you know, if you're smoking at whatever age it is, 13, 14, My goodness, what life do you have ahead of you? By the time you get to, is it, look, a 13, 14-year-old teenager smoking, they can't, it's just impossible for them to speculate what life feels like when they're 40 or 50. They just don't have any concept of mortality or anything like it. And you see in these public spaces, these kids in school uniforms smoking, and it just fills me with horror for them.
Crazy stuff. Even like, even at that age, they shouldn't be smoking. And then, plus, there's something like 80 chemicals in them, Stephen. That's the other thing. And you see them vaping too. I don't know how dangerous that is. I don't know what the science is behind that, but that's everywhere too, so it is. Terrible, Stephen. It is sad to see young people smoking. Like, I have seen that there. Like, you know,
it's awful.
Not good. Especially
then you start thinking about who's selling them to them and how are they getting them. And then they
might get them, you know, cheaper, you know, God knows from where, black market, Stephen, you know what I mean? That's not good for businesses, obviously, in layman's terms. Like, so.
It's awful. Listen, thank you, mate.
Cheers, Stephen. Thanks.
Thank you. Robert the taxi driver. Good morning, Robert.
How you doing, Stephen? Stephen, you know, a person like me came to taxi rank and you were coughing and stuff like that there, you know, saying, where are you going, mister? I'm going down to Mahee Island here. Right, no
problem. Would you let me in?
Oh, I'd let you in the back of the black taxi. I'd close the petition, get the mast on, get the windies down, you know, and travel along me. All joking aside. Well,
so you've got a mask, do you? Do you wear a mask these days?
Well, if you approach my taxi or anybody, all joking aside, who were coughing and stuff like that there, I would immediately have the mask on, Stephen. Put the mask on.
Yeah.
And have a windies down to let plenty of air circulate around the taxi. And as you know, I'm sure you've been in black taxis before. There's petitions in them. So
I've been in black taxis before. I used to get a taxi when I was a wee boy, going up and down the Shankill. I used to jump into the taxi twice a day. Twice a day into the black taxis. And you're saying to me, have you maybe been in a black taxi? I was in black taxis probably before you knew what they were.
I remember you working on the Royal Circular Road with three pumps in it, big Ricky's place. You were eating all the...
That's right.
You were eating all the burgers and everything in it.
That was the garage in the West Circular Road, and I used to go up to the microwave at the end of the shop and was constantly putting burgers into it and the hot dogs. How do you remember that?
Stephen, I've been around a long time. See, when you were hopping in the black taxis in Shankill, were you paying the fare?
Well, I'm going to tell you a true story, right? I'll share a true story with you today, Robert. So it goes like this. There used to be a snooker hall in the bottom of Westway Gardens, okay? Off the Ballygamartin Road, up there, okay? And I used to go into that hut all the time and play snooker. And I was this kind of 13, 14-year-old, and it was all older men in the snooker hall. So they were in their 30s, their 40s, and their 50s. So at that age, obviously, I'm 13, whatever age it is, I'm pretty gullible. And many of them were black taxi drivers. So one of the black taxi drivers, are you listening?
100% I'm listening.
So where do you hear this story? So one of the black taxi drivers says to me in front of all of the other snooker players one night, okay, you're a special member of this club now, so we're going to share with you the special password, the special code for black taxis. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, you don't need to bring money with you anymore. All you need to do when you get into a black taxi, when the driver drops you off at the bottom of the Shankill Road there, when you're going into town,
and the
North Street, you just say service. This is a true story. You say service. And that gets you a free journey every time. So there I am, this 13-year-old, gullible, believing this. So what do? I get into the taxi the next day. There's me heading into town. I think it was 50p at the time. And we're going back many years ago. So I get down to the bottom of the road. And I say to this driver, service. And he says, what? And I said, service. And he said, what the F are you talking about? And I said, I don't pay for this taxi, service. And he looked at me as if he was about to deck me. So what did I do? I had no money. I had to get out and do a runner. Because I believed these buck idiots at the top of the Ballymartin Road and that snooker hut.
You wouldn't be the first one to do a runner in a black taxi, Stephen.
But I did a runner as a kid because I said I believed them. That's a true story.
He must have thought you said the Secret Service. Maybe he was that, but he maybe picked the up on and thought you said the Secret Service.
Oh.
that's a good one, Stephen.
That's a true story.
That's a cracker. But you're not the old joke to say, you're not the first one to do a runner in an out black taxi, you know. Taxi drivers suffer out at the weekends.
Do you know what I think I should do? I think I should go back and give that 50p fare that I owe to a taxi driver just to make sure it quits. Listen, thank you very much, Robert. Morning to you.
Thanks, Stephen. Have a nice morning. Cheerio.
John and Palomino. Morning, John.
Good morning, Stephen. You keep saying ring the doctor. Well, you can't ring the doctor. You can ring the health centre and speak to a receptionist. But I can't remember a time when you ever could ring the doctor. And I'm in my 70s.
Well, you're right. You're taking me literally now. What I mean, ring a doctor. You know what I mean.
Well, ring the health centre.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Important advice there. Thousands of passengers are facing potential travel chaos this weekend. We've been hearing this in the news, haven't we? Pilots working for Aer Lingus have begun industrial action. Ongoing pay dispute. Simon Calder's waiting to speak to us. What on earth is going on, Simon?
I'm afraid, Stephen, it's looking pretty bleak for anybody in Northern Ireland who has planned, as many people do every year, to have their summer holidays starting with a flight typically out of Dublin, going either to North America or to continental Europe because, yes, pilots at midnight began an indefinite work to rule in pursuit of a 24% pay claim. There were some talks at the Labour Court in Dublin yesterday. They got nowhere, I'm afraid. And so on top of this, which is seeing today and for the next week, 26 Aer Lingus flights cancelled a day. We're also going to have an 8-hour strike on Saturday, which is going to lead to the cancellation of, I count, nearly 100 flights. So anybody booked on Aer Lingus, I can imagine, is feeling quite anxious at this stage. The airline says it has told passengers who are booked on those flights, you know, here's what we're proposing instead. But it's not a great start to the summer, I'm afraid.
And is it it's obviously part of the umbrella group, isn't it? The AIG umbrella group, which also owns British Airways. So yeah, does this have a knock-on effect on British Airways as people are maybe travelling on holiday with them too or not?
Well, it's going to affect lots of people in the Republic who are flying typically from Dublin to Heathrow and on from there on British Airways. And it's actually oddly not affecting people in GB who are flying from Manchester to North America because that's a separate organisation. But the main thing is that IAG, this holding company which owns BA, Iberia of Spain, Aer Lingus, Vueling of Spain, appears to be saying, no, we are going to fight this claim by the pilots' union. The pilots are traditionally, belonging to the Irish Airline Pilots Association, really quite active in pursuit of their claim. They say they just want to make up for the money they've lost since 2019. They say that the airline is prepared to talk only if they're prepared to change some of their terms and conditions. And yes, it looks very, very unsettled at the moment. And of course, even talk of a strike, let alone beginning industrial action, means that causes uncertainty for lots of passengers. It also means that people will switch away to other airlines, and that will see prices soar and seats become difficult to find. So a pretty bleak start to the summer, I'm afraid.
So what about, Simon, a particular situation which could affect Northern Ireland punters. And, you know, I've been one of them in the past many times, actually. So taxes are cheaper, as you know, from Dublin.
Yep.
So for those people who are going off on a summer holiday here, maybe to America, wherever, and they've deliberately decided to book their ticket starting in Dublin because you pay lower airport taxes there, the fares can be significantly cheaper sometimes, not all the time. So for those people who are then getting a connecting flight with Aer Lingus in order to get British Airways, their partner, to fly them elsewhere around the world, what happens to them? Will BA get them there because it's part of that umbrella group that owns Aer Lingus, or are they screwed?
Well, if you have got, as you should have, a ticket which starts in Dublin, it might be going to Heathrow and then onwards from there to somewhere in Asia, perhaps, then you are in a very good position because Aer Lingus, and indeed British Airways, is governed by European air passenger rights rules. And they say that if you are cancelling a flight, doesn't matter why, then you have to find Stephen Nolan an alternative way of getting to his destination on the same day, if any possibility is available. And yes, absolutely, I use Dublin the whole time to get to North America because I want to avoid the very high air passenger duty. So I've got one, actually, it's on WestJet going to Canada later in the summer. But if you're booked on Aer Lingus direct to North America, then, well, you've got Air Canada, American Airlines, Delta, JetBlue, United, or WestJet, all of whom, if your flight isn't going, you can say to Aer Lingus, you've got to book me on that. I'm seeing a number of passengers getting in touch with me saying, but they said I had to travel 2 days later. That's nonsense. You should be able to get a booking on the same day. The main drawback to that is that sometimes if the airline won't necessarily cooperate, you can say, right, I'm going to book it and then claim back money. So you're going to need a pretty heavy duty credit card for that. And secondly, seats might not be available, but it's definitely you're right. As with Black Taxi, just say service.
Simon, thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Always lovely to talk to you. Service. I'm going to regret telling that story now, aren't I? Rosemary, good morning.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's a true story, though. And all everybody that's currently, that new generation, whoever they are, that's in that snooker hut in the bottom of the Westway Gardens should know how I was conned by their past players. Go ahead, Rosemary.
Now, I'm on the subject of smoking.
Yes.
Both my parents were smokers. Mother particularly was very heavy. Now, I am 82. I have never, ever had a cigarette in my mouth. 7 years ago, my mother died actually when she was 57 with lung cancer, and that made me even more determined that I would not have a cigarette in my mouth. 7 years ago, I had a third of a lung removed, and I can only put it down to the amount of smoke that was in my house when my mother was alive.
My goodness.
So I think there is a tale there for people to listen about smoking. Fortunately, I am well at the moment, but it always reminded me of Roy Castles a few years ago when he said he was a non-smoker, but because he went to clubs and so on, he was bringing it in and into his lungs, and he died of lung cancer.
And did your doctor tell you that there was a fair chance you got it from the passive smoking of your mother?
Well, now, Stephen, I'm 82 and she was 57 and I don't remember anything like that. I mean, she was warned about smoking.
Okay.
But it didn't, because I was so much younger and I had no brothers or sisters. And obviously I loved my parents dearly, but I've never forgotten that I still have a third of my lung removed and they do keep an eye on it for me.
Well, Rosemary, thank you for calling us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening.
Not a problem. See you later. As you can hear, the music started. That's it. Are we hour and a half when the mornings fly in, don't they? But sure, we've been doing it for 20-odd years together, and we'll do it tomorrow morning again for more Nolan at 9. So have a good day, everyone, tomorrow. I'll see you at 9 o'clock. Bye-bye, and thanks for listening.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Sommer. Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
What are the most memorable travel adventures? Those where we open our eyes and our minds to new experiences. It's all to see here in Azerbaijan. New flavors, a new appreciation of ancient history, of natural beauty and of rich contrasts. This is a world of culture, cuisine, wellness and adventure, all yours for the taking. Thought you knew Azerbaijan? Take another look. To plan your Azerbaijan adventure, visit azerbaijan.travel.